This is the Dharma Podcast at dharmapodcast.org, and this is show number 152, titled The Invisibles. It was recorded July 8th, 2009.
So I'd like to welcome you this evening, and I'd like to welcome back David. It's wonderful to have you here with us this evening, David. Last week, David spoke about the earthly presence of the present moment and reminded us that the present moment is always local and always more than human. And this week, he'll talk about the invisibles. I have no idea what they are, but I kept thinking of the Invincibles all week. So I'm curious to find out what comes forth. It's been quite a powerful week, and I so appreciate your presence here with us this evening, David. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yes, so last week, as Jason said, I was riffing on the earthly presence of the present moment. And these very simple obviousnesses that the present moment, it seems to me, is always local. It's not what's happening on the far side of the world. It's right here, the aspect of the world that I meet with all my senses. And that the present moment is always a more than human thing. It's never just constituted by me or by the other two-leggeds around. There's always other elementals at work, like the soil, like a mosquito buzzing by, like the ground, the air that is being sort of percolated not just within the lungs of humans and of coyotes, but within the leaves of cottonwoods and cedars. I think some aspect of my own practice involves this, trying to call attention to the very obvious and hence very easily overlooked aspects of the real. To begin to notice how utterly strange is the ordinary world that we meet face to face every day. How inexhaustibly weird it is, and hence worthy of our wonder and our astonishment and our curiosity and fascination. This very palpable, sensuous body and this palpable, sensuous, buzzing, blooming terrain that our body is a part of, that is inhabited by me, my family, my friends, neighbors, but also by these folks who swoop and squawk overhead and whose leaves flutter outside my window. The real in its wonder. I think one of the ways we rob this palpable earthly world of its wonder is by so often projecting the deepest truth of things somewhere else. Somewhere outside the world, the source. I mean, this world is, okay, it's real enough, but the real mysterious, the source of this world exists beyond the world, or behind the world, or underneath it, or hidden from our direct apprehension, not just invisible, but utterly intangible in some heaven behind the stars. That's, of course, a very traditional notion in the Western world. But there are many other heavens which we meet in our own day. Many of the spiritual traditions and the new spiritual traditions currently emerging still have a tendency, especially those that are born of the West, to see or sense or imagine that the deepest source of things, the deepest truth of things, is hidden behind the appearances, somewhere else, in an unseen dimension that is utterly beyond all bodily ken, so that the unconditioned realm is conceived of and felt as being somewhere other than right here in this moment where we meet. Here is the conditioned world of appearances, the 10,000 things, and then there's the unconditioned realm where we might say all is one. And that exists, of course, only by dissolving the 10,000 things and the appearances. And so opening oneself to a dimension that is often thought of as elsewhere. So I want to, this afternoon, just question that, open that up, loosen that habit of thought so common in the West, and suggest that the invisible is precisely in the visible. That's why we call it the invisible. It's in the visible. That the visible world is pregnant with invisibility and is constituted of invisibility right here around us as we sit. I mean, there are these very simple, so close to us, invisibles, that we just don't notice them. We take them so much for granted. Aspects of our world that are, yes, hidden to our eyes, but that's not to say that they are not here, or that they are utterly intangible, because they're not. They are very much of our felt reality. The feelings, the sensations, the palpable experience of my voice speaking now, of your breath. One such invisible, really simple and obvious, is, especially as perhaps we should also allow that, not just when we're sitting, but when we're walking, going about our everyday, utterly mundane day-to-day experiences. We pass by things, buildings, trees, rocks, boulders. But there is an aspect of these things that is very unseen by us as we walk by them, which is simply the other side of that boulder, the other side of that building, the other side of the hill that I gaze from my house every morning. The other side of things, which we don't see directly. But if we walk around the boulder, there it is. Except now the first side has become invisible to me. And so I'll walk back to that side. But I cannot get rid of that invisibility, that invisible dimension, the other side of each thing that surrounds me, including the other side of my own body. I can't quite see it. It's invisible to my gaze. I can't quite catch it. I mean, in the most intimate sense, yes, the other side of our own body. In the largest sense, the more public and massive sense, it's what is hidden beyond the horizon of our daily encounters. Just over the horizon, hidden by the world that we directly experience. We know that there are lands there beyond the horizon, but we don't see them directly. They are hidden to our gaze. This is a kind of invisibility that is very ordinary and very real, and that we experience all the time and tend to take for granted. There are others, like the inside of the tree, the inside of the boulder, the inside of my own body and of your body as I look at you, which is very different from the other side of your body or the other side of that tree. What, you know, as I'm walking past a tree, it's true, I don't see the other side and I don't always walk over to check it out and make sure that the other side has bark just like this side. It may, in fact, just be plasticized on the other side and be a sort of pink plastic expanse as I walk. But it's interesting. I tend to fill in that invisible with my own, with the imagination of my eyes. I have a sense that there's bark there. But I certainly don't see the inside of that tree. Who knows what's going on in there? I assume, and my body, or the imagination of my own body, fills that hiddenness with something of my own viscera, my own density. So I have a sense that that tree has a thickness of layered wood within, perhaps with some termites moving up in the interstices as the sap is rising in the day. But it could be entirely hollow and have not termites, but a set of vaguely humanoid elves climbing up and down on ladders. It's entirely possible because I don't know. I don't see it directly. Nor the inside of a rock or the inside of the houses I pass. There's this strange hiddenness within things that is invisible to my experience. And this is something our body experiences daily. This is most intimate in the inside of my own body, my own flesh. I don't have direct visible encounter with it, though I can hear its gurglings and feel them often enough. It's invisible. It is in the visible. In its most public and massive sense, that invisibility of what is hidden within is also what is hidden then under the ground. Inside not just the rocks and the boulders, but inside the hill across the valley. Inside this massive earth, precisely hidden by the ground that supports me. Under the ground. And we all experience that all the time. And yet I believe we take it profoundly for granted. We don't experience the weirdness that, say, the Puebloan peoples of this region do, whose sense of their own deep source and origin is that they come from under the ground, that they emerged from a world that is now deep under the ground. When that world got too chaotic and confused and was bursting apart at the seams, the people climbed up a reed, almost like corn growing up out of the ground. They emerged into the next world. And then again, when that world got screwed up, they had to climb eons later into the third world. And then, finally, now, into the fourth world, as many of the Hopi understand it, as many of the Puebloan peoples experience this world. So the under the ground is a sacred, holy place that we walk upon. It supports us here in the present moment. And yet it is a realm of mystery that we don't have direct visual contact with. It's invisible. It's interesting because these invisibles, like what is hidden beyond the horizon, which so many native peoples as well have a very intense sense of its mystery, its holiness. It is often spoken of, you know, you can hear it spoken of as the happy hunting ground for the Plains Indians. It's always just beyond the mountains on the horizon. For the Puebloan Indians around here, it's when one dies and slips into another form or opens outward, feeding back into the surrounding landscape and terrain, but one's spirit journeys just beyond the horizon, often to a lake beyond the horizon, where the Kachinas dwell, for instance. There is that sense of El Dorado, the land of gold, or the land of milk and honey, beyond the horizon. It holds that promise, the horizon does, and withholds it from our direct encounter. But what's remarkable is that everything we now speak of as the future, and that tends to hold us out of felt relation with the actual terrain here, including the horizon, because I am worried about what's going to happen in the future, so I've got to get a better insurance policy, and what are we going to do next year when Hannah has to shift to another school? And I get caught in these mental worries projecting a future that exists somewhere else. Everything we now call the future, it seems to me, is actually a kind of intellectual abstraction from what our animal body experiences as what is hidden beyond the horizon. It is here, just over the horizon. Well, there's a near future too. It's what's hidden just behind this rock, or just on the other side of this leaf, from whence a spider may suddenly come crawling into my present. But I couldn't see it a moment ago, because it was behind the branch. There's that near future, just behind things, that suddenly, as I make a few steps, it comes into presence and a part of my present moment. But then there's the open future, the larger future that sometimes rides toward us from beyond the horizon like clouds gather and suddenly come sweeping over the terrain from beyond the horizon. The future, in some very important sense, was once experienced as simply that promise, an enigmatic openness held beyond the horizon. And what we get so concerned about preserving of the past, everything we call now the past and believe we know it exists, it just doesn't exist here. It doesn't have anything to do with this world that we bodily inhabit, but we go into our heads and worry about, how could I have done that last week? And, oh, shit, you know, I've got to be in touch with him and tell him that, you know, I didn't mean it. And the past is where, in so many ways, what we now call the past is a kind of intellectual abstraction that is drawn from or rooted in what our animal body once experienced as that enigmatic depth under the ground. It is hidden from view, but by its way of hiding, it supports the present moment. We walk upon it. That density and depth under the ground. If you want to know the deep past of a region, of a valley like this one, you dig down and look at the layers of soil and learn about what happened in recent decades and then recent epochs. And you dig down deeper and can find layers of the deep past under the ground. If you want to know the recent past, well, look just inside any nearby tree. You core the tree and take out a little sort of thin stick that you can see all of the layers in the grain. And if you count from the outside in, at 12 layers in, there's a very wide layer, wider than the others. What's that about? Ah, well, 12 years ago, there was a lot more rain. And so the tree grew a lot more there. And you keep counting back, and here at 35 years into the depth of the past, it's a very, very thin layer because there was a drought there. The past is hidden inside things, inside our own body. We carry it. It is here in this way. And the deep past, under the ground. And the past, by its way of being invisible or hiding from our eyes, makes itself felt within the visible as something quite sturdy and dense that supports us, this ground. The future, by its way of hiding from the open presence of the present, it hides in a very different way, behind things, even beyond the horizon. Its way of hiding or being invisible to our eyes is a kind of openness. It's not closed like the past. You can step into the future. I can walk toward the horizon. But will I walk toward this part of the horizon or that part? It's always open. And whichever I walk toward will open up around me and become my new present. So the horizon holds open the present moment. The lands beyond the horizon, by their way of hiding from the present moment, they hold open this present moment. I know that's odd, enigmatic. I hope it's also oddly simple, what I'm saying. That in some strange way, the other moments of time are not elsewhere. They're here. Right under us, just behind the hill. And by feeling time in that way, we begin to settle more deeply into the richness of the present moment. But there's another invisibility, a third mode of hiding, a third mode of being hidden from our eyes, concealed from our visual experience, and yet being very, very present within the visible world around. Not just the other side of things, not just what is inside the things, but also what is between us and the thing. Between you and I, between me and that tree, or between me and that boulder, is something I don't see. And because it's invisible, I can see through it to your face. It is the invisibility of the air in which we are immersed, that swirls between us and all around us, and circulates in through my nostrils, moving within my chest. And then I breathe it out, and it circulates within the room between your body and my body, as your breath mingles with mine, as our breaths mingle with the breath of the grasses and the leaves and the needles of all these rooted folks who breathe in the carbon dioxide we breathe out, who breathe out the oxygen we breathe in. So we're all exchanging breath with these beings. What we breathe out, they breathe in. What they breathe out, we breathe in. It is as if we are of one element together. And this mysterious medium is also, I think, oddly, very oddly, taken utterly for granted by us, because we don't see it. And because we don't see it, we assume there's nothing there. We don't speak of the air between me and a nearby tree. We just speak of the empty space between us, or the empty space between you and I here as we sit in the room. We don't speak of the air, but this is not empty. It's full. It's filled with unseen goings-on, with these vortices just beneath our nostrils, and the vortices made by my hand as it moves in the air, or your body as it bends and stretches. And trails of scent that any mosquito tracks and follows into our skin, which are unseen by our eyes. All of these strange unfoldings in the air that I was driving up yesterday from Albuquerque, and there were clouds in the sky, but the clouds, curiously, are, and you may notice this sometimes when you're heading back or walking back toward this valley from the south, how the clouds tend to cluster above the mountains, above the Jemez, above the Sangres, and there's little puffed clouds above the small hills near La Cienega. And else. So there's some alchemy between the mountains and even the hills and the atmosphere that conjures these clouds out of the depths. What is that? We certainly don't see it, but it is an astonishment, a beauty, a wonder. So many things are going on in the unseen air. It's the very place of the spirits for the native peoples of this land. When they speak of the spirits, we who are born of families that originate in Europe tend to interpret the spirits as being, oh, the spirit, this is, it's not just invisible, it's entirely intangible. It's a dimension that is supernatural, beyond all bodily experience. But for the native peoples of this land, when they speak of the spirits, they mean something much more akin to the little gusts of wind and the particular winds that curl down from the high passes at dusk and roll down the mountainsides. Each of those has its particular quality, and there's a particular wind that rolls along this riverbed, even when there's no water in it, at dawn and at dusk, a spirit. And even, you know, the very subtle whiffs that bring you knowledge of what the neighbor is cooking tonight. That's the spirit. It's invisible. You can't see it. I don't know if you folks know, but the word spirit is simply born of this old Latin word spiritus, which originally meant just a breath or a gust of wind. That's what the spirit was. The word psyche, from which we get psychology and psychiatry and eco-psychology and psychosomatic. Psyche, what's that word? Well, it comes directly from the old Greek word, psyche. It was then pronounced psuche, but spelled basically the same, psuche. And it originally meant a breath or a gust of wind. Psyche as a gust of wind. It's as if the air itself is aware. Even such a word as anima, from which we get animal. Anima is the Latin word for soul. Animal, an ensouled being, not quite as richly ensouled, we think, as ourselves, but it has a soul nonetheless. Anima. Anima, the soul, animation. That which has soul, animism, believing in souls, in all things. Anima is, well, it comes from an older non-Latin but Greek word, animos, which meant wind. Anima originally means just the wind, or a breath, which is our part of the wind. A very scientifically respectable word like atmosphere, where does that come from? Anybody know? Atmosphere. Actually, not Greek, but Sanskrit origin. Atman. Atman, the word for the soul. The older root of both words is atmos, the Sanskrit and Indo-European root, which means, atmos means the air, which is the soul which is the air. It means air and soul inseparably. In fact, if you take the words for soul, spirit, psyche, in any language and trace them back to their oral origins, you will find at least one of those words is naming the air as the very body of that mystery we call mind or spirit or soul. The air. The air is the mystery of mysteries. For most of the, I would say for all of the indigenous peoples of this earth, certainly all those that I've had the luck to, you know, spend bits of time with, which is a tiny, tiny handful, but I know this from my own speaking and my own reading and learning of native peoples everywhere. The air is, this is where the spirits hang out. It's right here. It's very palpable. But somehow we lost that sense. In ancient Greece, beginning with Plato, suddenly the air, the spirit, the psyche, began to be spoken of as a dimension that is not just invisible, it's entirely intangible. And it comes from somewhere else, beyond the fixed stars, the outermost visible aspect of the world. Behind that, said Plato, is the heaven where the soul comes from. But by projecting that source outside the world, the West has robbed this earthly world of its mystery, its wonder, its rich depth. So we say things like, well, we live on the earth. Or we were put here on the earth to keep this place and make it good. And the animals were put here to serve us. Put here by what? Well, by some intelligence from outside. But even for those of us who don't particularly believe in an intelligence or a source outside the world, we still say that we live on the earth. We walk on the earth. Our home is on the earth. But that's a goof. Because, I mean, when we walk outside, like today, if you look up, there's often a few clouds floating in the sky, way, way up there. And those clouds are often just sort of lolling there as they float. But we know that this earth is spinning very rapidly around its axis. Around the equator, it's spinning at about 2,000 miles an hour to the east. Very fast. Here at this latitude, it's more like 1,000 miles an hour, 900 miles an hour, perhaps. That's pretty damn fast. So, wait a minute. Those clouds way up there, they ought to be speeding off toward the west. Shooting off toward the west as we speed 900 miles an hour beneath them. So we ought to see those clouds going. But they're not even heading toward the west at all today. They're just sort of lollygagging up and floating off toward the north. How can that be? If the earth is spinning so fast. How can that be? Unless the clouds up there are accompanying the earth as it moves. Because those clouds are entirely a part of the earth. Because that's earth up there. And so we don't live on the earth. We live in the earth. We are immersed in this unseen medium of air. And we cannot move, we cannot walk, we cannot think a single thought without continually imbibing this invisible substance that we share with all the other animals and the plants and the clouds. We are immersed in this fluid atmosphere of earth. Embedded within it, along with all these other critters. Sometimes I have taken to writing the earth when I'm a writer sometimes as well, and I spell it in an odd way. I've taken to writing it E-A-I-R-T-H. E-A-I-R-T. So A-I-R is in the middle of the word because it's a part of the earth. And by inserting an I in the word, I say that I, myself, that I, which seems to me just stands for that upright letter, is the spine of the human, this curious animal who stood up on its hind legs. My I is immersed in air, and the air is entirely a part of the air. The air. We are of one body with this breathing planet. one spirit with the swooping crows and the butterflies and the caterpillars, the cedars, the storm clouds, the lightning, the sandstone, the red lichen spreading on the sandstone, the crinkly black lichens huddled. We are of one psyche with these soils, these streams, these spiders, these jackrabbits. Flesh of its flesh. This is my small body. And this big breathing earth is my larger body floating in the heavens, my eternal body out of which I'm born and into which I unfurl and turn inside out at death, spreading back into this vast spinning eternal life afloat in heaven. But the heaven is not elsewhere. The deepest source of things is not somewhere else. It's right here. The invisible is in the visible. The unconditioned is not another realm behind the appearances. It's right here between you and I. Between us, this invisible depth. The invisibles. In the visible. Thanks. Last week took a few questions, if there's any any questing or questioning after anything I've said, please. Yeah, yeah.
Do you know that mathematically speaking, there is a probability that every time you inhale, you will inhale one molecule of what Caesar expelled when he said at two root. So there is a oneness in the universe.
And it's right here? Yeah.
This goes back to the beginning of your talk. You mentioned emerging spiritualities, emerging spiritual traditions in this day and age. I'm wondering if you could elucidate that a little further. If you could give some examples or name some.
Well,
what is to be?
I was at the beginning of my rap, I think I was alluding to and taking a bit of distance from some of our very traditional Western and monotheistic ways of experiencing the deepest truth always imagining or projecting it outside the world, beyond, hidden somewhere behind the appearances. And this is true not necessarily of Buddhism, but of our Western, often Christian, interpretations of Buddhism tend to do the same thing, to speak of the unconditioned dimension as somewhere else. That in order to access it, you need to dissolve your own sense of your own physicality and disidentify with your body and recognize yourself as just pure spirit. But so I was first suggesting there that, wait a minute, I mean, my body partakes of pure spirit continually. I don't have to leave my body to notice my body's utter entanglement with the invisible breath, the wind, the air, the breath of this soil. So, but then the emerging spiritualities I was alluding to first there, or at that moment when I was speaking, were many of the New Age spiritual possibilities or spiritual alternatives that have for a couple decades now and more similarly invited people to step or disidentify with their bodies and their bodily and hence their animal experience to get out of the body. Out of the body experiences are valued. No, you're not your body, you are spirit. Or you're, speaking of everything very often as it's all one. It's all one. Well, yes, it certainly is. But it's also all wonderfully multiple and differentiated. And I don't want to ignore this spider's curious difference from me. Because if I do, then I can't fall in love with how bizarre it that being is who walks with eight legs. I mean, it's just outrageous. And, you know, meanwhile, the pinyon pine is alchemizing sunlight directly, you know, out of the air like the cottonwoods are, drinking it and turning it into the flesh. I can't do that. So, I mean, these beings are all so richly different from one another, as you are different from me. And so, it seems to me, we don't have to dissolve the richness of this multiform, many-voiced world, this earth, in order to touch the sacred, or even feel our rich unity with things. It's enough to notice we're breathing the same air and we're co-creating this air. To notice, well, so, but then there are other emerging spiritualities that are really emerging in the sense of I have a sense that there is a whole new sense of the sacred that is trying to be born at this time in the world. And it's leaking out of us unexpectedly through our words or through our actions. And it's something entirely new because it is an utterly imminent sense of the holy, a sense of the sacred that is not anywhere other than right here. This is the source. The Big Bang is not something that happened 15 billion years ago. It is what is coming out of my mouth now and your mouth as you laugh or speak. It's this sound. The creation is happening at every moment. This is the source. This world. This moment. This air. And these spiritualities, it seems to me, begin to call us back to our own embodiment, our own animal senses waking up, and hence our bodies beginning to notice the larger body that we are utterly entangled with. This breathing air, this many-voiced, holy, eternal, utterly sacred and delicate and yet so richly endangered presence that we have brought into peril, not because we're mean, not because we're ugly creatures, but simply because we have forgotten to notice. We've stopped noticing how inexhaustibly strange and luminous this world is in its wonder, and weird and enigmatic and mysterious and holy. Yeah.
So how could we have forgotten this? I mean, why have we forgotten it? I mean, if that's really who we are, how could we have even begun to go outside, called outside? I mean, do you know like what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
How could we have done this? Why?
It's a really precious question, and a big one. And it's so precious because in beginning to discern how and why, we perhaps get real clues as to how we find our way back to our senses and back to Earth and back inside back inside the sacred. So I'll just gesture a tiny bit by saying, I don't know. But I think each of us has clues within us. What I feel in myself is the hows are complex, and there's not one how. It has happened over centuries, and there are many strong moments when it got accelerated. But the why is what empowered those moments and made it so that when there was a way to step out, we so often went for it, because to stay in the presence of the present, to stay in the full-bodied mystery of the real in its wonder is frightening. It's dangerous. The real is not a nice place. It's not a pretty place, as people have come to think of nature as pretty and sweet. It's dangerous. There are things out there that are bigger than us that can eat us. The real is wild. And the wild is, it's beautiful, to be sure, but it ain't pretty. It is shot through with difficulty and shadow. And yes, to know one is a part of a world that is alive through and through is to know we are a part of something that is wild, where there are beings that can eat us and that will ultimately eat us. So I'm not in control. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm vulnerable. And it's, I think, this sense of being out of control, of being vulnerable, that we can't abide. Vulnerable especially to one another, to the gaze of another person. I don't know what you're thinking, and you're looking at me, and maybe you're thinking ill of me. That's quite a vulnerability, to stay fully embodied here. But I'm also vulnerable to disease, to swine flu, to illness, to death, and to just the utter openness of the present moment, from whence a storm cloud may come tumbling into view and wreck my plans. And so to stay and to come back into this realm is it takes a sense of adventure. It takes courage, and an openness to the unexpected, to being surprised, but also an openness to grief, to loss. And the grief, the loss, the suffering is utterly integral to the holy, to the good in its richest, deepest sense. And that's what makes it beautiful rather than pretty, is because it has that ingredient of grief within it. And so I think that is the why, is that it's hard and it's difficult. And for many, it's frightening. But if we come, as we are drawn back in, we discover a world that is dangerous and difficult. But it's also a world that is filled with astonishment and magic and utter joy. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you.